Thank you very much. As we descend into the evening and the night, it's, I guess, appropriate that the last talk is more popular music. I will use this music stand, which is, of course, a signifier of high art, but I hope you'll allow me to do that. There's a number of similar questions and themes, particularly this idea of going back to roots and going back to, although for hip-hop as a genre it doesn't go back quite as far, there is this urge to go back to the origins of a self-conscious genre. I thought I would start with just a few research questions and themes that may emerge more through the conference in general, and some of them address my paper specifically. I mean, how to write a history of popular music, or any history of music, I think is being covered, and we've already heard lots of interesting things about that. I'm going to be focusing quite a bit on how to study previous historical accounts of the origins of a genre. And I was initially going to talk and give a paper here about, how to teach a history of popular music as a sort of new canon and those problems that arise. But I thought this might be more appropriate anyway. And the main focus, this fourth question, is really the concern of my paper today, which is how knowledge of a history, or, one type of history, is embedded within, what some musicologists call the music itself. This idea of referencing and intertextuality within the intermusical discourse. And I'm a big fan of the music itself not just being, the score, the notes, but for popular music at least, everything that's on the recording. So when I'm talking about intramusical, when I'm talking about the music itself, I'm including all the material that's on a recording. So you'll hear lyric, ideas and things like that as well. I should say the other reason that I decided to focus on this is because my book deadline is looming, and I want to think about these things more, and this comprises the first chapter of this book that I'm almost done with. Chapter 2 would be interesting for the first paper of the session, of course. Construction of jazz rap is high art, the use of jazz here. But today I'm talking about the first chapter. Okay, so the complex relationship between an artistic culture and its history can be investigated from two large-scale methodological angles. There's probably more, but the first, there's the relationship between that culture and its historical influences and precedents, linking past to present to form a network of lineage or traditions, what I call the ancestral method. This is very common in studies of hip-hop and jazz as well, where you go back to sort of African roots, African features, which you now find in African-American-based musics. The second method, looks at the relationship between a self-conscious culture and its own internal history, its origins, development, or evolution, and its defining features. So what I'm calling here intercultural hermeneutics, this could perhaps apply to a genre of music or to a nation or various things. And of course, these boundaries are constructed. Of course, the boundaries between internal and external dynamics of a culture or a musical culture are by no means impermeable. I outline these two hermeneutical methods because they're often utilized by academics, fan cultures, and the media to investigate and construct particular artistic cultures. While the connections with pre-hip-hop ancestry are often useful and enlightening, my interest lies in analyzing hip-hop history from within the hip-hop world, an imaginary community that journalist Touré identifies as the hip-hop nation. So I think there's some links here with nationalism and the way that hip-hop gets talked about in journalism is as a nation. Okay, there's a lot of that out there. Rather than theorize answers to why genre self-consciousness is so abundant in hip-hop, today I'll show one instance of intracultural borrowing from within the hip-hop world, focusing on the origins and romanticization of a pre-recording hip-hop performance culture as a source of hip-hop authenticity. I call this concern with hip-hop history, for lack of a better term, historical authenticity. That you're demonstrating the knowledge of history through the music. It should be stated that my focus and interest is not necessarily on the accuracy of historical detail, and I know that could be extremely problematic, but I'm noting what becomes used as an imagined space said to represent hip-hop's roots, what Lois Zamora calls a usable past. So I'm going to explain... the first half really is about these early accounts, these accounts of early hip-hop, and then go on to ways that they're used and invoked in later hip-hop examples. So kind of the origin myths here. For certain hip-hop purists, the truest form of hip-hop culture existed from 1973 to 1979, before hip-hop was commercialized in the form of recordings. It was during this time period that what became known as the four elements of hip-hop arose in the South Bronx. Graffiti, breakdancing, DJing, and emceeing, which is rapping. These artistic movements all shared the urban spaces of the Bronx, with artists often engaging with more than one of these elements. Now, like the Finnish example we had earlier, the origin of hip-hop can be traced back to a single time and place. A specific date, as the history goes. At 1520 Sedgwick Avenue in Morris Heights in the Bronx on August 11, 1973, when Jamaican-born DJ Kool Herc threw his first party. What separated Herc from the other DJs at the time was that he did something different with the records. He decided to loop and combine the instrumental breaks of records, since that was the portion of the song the dancers seemed to like the most. A number of breakbeats are mentioned in early accounts, such as the middle section of James Brown's Give It Up or Turn It Loose, and Incredible Bongo Band's version of Apache. So the breakbeat, just to quickly define here, is usually an instrumental break from a funk record, but it doesn't have to necessarily be funk. And these can be either linked together or using two copies of the same breakbeat to create a loop. That's the sort of origin of these funk-based, what they call breakbeats. And DJ Kool Herc is the founding father. Afrika Bambaataa organized his first party in November 1976 at the Bronx River Community Center. Inspired by Herc's break-centered style as opposed to a song-centered DJ style. In addition to funk music, he played instrumental portions of the Monkees, the Beatles, Aerosmith, and Kraftwerk. For Bambaataa, using the instrumental fragment eradicated an element of racial identity and genre categorization, so artist and genre mattered less than sound and danceability. And the audience, the dancers, were very important in that equation. If they weren't dancing, it wouldn't have worked. Other DJs began to emerge and improve on the conceptual approach initiated by DJ Kool Herc, such as Grandmaster Flash, credited with advances in mixing, and Grand Wizard Theodore, you gotta love these names, who is credited with inventing record scratching as a turntable technique. MCs, or rappers, arrived soon after, speaking over the instrumental tracks and forming groups and associations with certain DJs. By 1979, hip-hop music reached a larger audience with the release of the first hit rap single, Rapper's Delight, by the Sugar Hill Gang. It received copious amounts of radio play and sold numerous units. This was the moment when hip-hop music reached a national audience and eventually the whole world. Many historical accounts romanticize this pre-recorded period of hip-hop from 1973 to 1979. In fact, Jeff Chang called Rapper's Delight the first death of hip-hop. His history, which is a very thick book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation, is a narrative of decline, romanticizing the South Bronx artistically while simultaneously portraying the dismal economic and social conditions. for him and others, and there's countless examples. This is when hip-hop was urban, spontaneous, live, full of creativity, and innovative. It was where competition was collaboration, often perceived as a peaceful solution to gang warfare, and was unmediated by business in the form of corporate infrastructures. And unlike the misogyny of later rap, women had more important artistic roles in the early movement. And that's one way that this dichotomy gets set up as well. Chang's sentiments are shared by a number of current or post-1979 rap artists who use the imagery and music of this past time to signal a form of their own authenticity as a sort of subcultural capital, to use Sarah Thorne's term. Can people see that okay? Is that all right? So basically what I'm doing here is I'm noting the different ways that current or fairly current groups invoke this earlier historical time period. And I'll just outline some of these in a little bit more detail. Most crucial to the imagery of hip-hop historical authenticity are representations of urban space. So the comments about sort of landscape before, I mean, this is the kind of landscapes we're dealing with in this genre. And it's very important to the genre. The urban landscape of the Bronx was crucial to early hip-hop. It provided the space for graffiti art, breakdancers, and DJs who wired their system into lampposts in the city. The 1982 film Wild Style, often said to capture the essence of true hip-hop, is a good example of this particular urban ethos, to use Adam Krim's term. The mixing of numerous cultures and backgrounds, including Jamaican-born immigrants and Puerto Ricans, would only have been available in an urban setting, what Robin Kelly calls polyculturalism. The urban ethos of historical authenticity is one that depicts multiple signifiers of hip-hop culture with a focus on the party or the jam, as exemplified in the climactic jam at the amphitheater in Wild Style. Geography is crucial to many forms of hip-hop authenticity, about which both Murray Forman and Adam Krims have written extensively. Imagery can also take the form of old flyers for hip-hop shows, such as this one, found in the CD booklet of De La Soul's album, The Grind Date, from 2004, paradoxically promoting an aesthetic of liveness on their recording. That's an earlier 1982 flyer there. Other ways to show historical authenticity is the use of what are now called classic breakbeats or vinyl scratches, as well as peer references to rappers, DJs, and breakdancing crews. Artists can quote from earlier rap songs, such as the Beastie Boys' quotation of Double Trouble, which is in that film Wild Style, on their own single, Triple Trouble. And I'll just play this example for you. Let's try Double Trouble first. Okay, Beastie Boys, Triple Trouble, fairly Okay, and so it's verbal quotation. Stylistic allusion, alluding to earlier hip-hop styles. Artists and groups can suggest the old school without direct references to the past, either with earlier styles of flow, you know, or rap, or by using older equipment such as the Roland T808 drum machine. I'll play one quick example of that alludes to Afrika Bambaataa's Planet Rock. And this is a jazz musician, Russell Gunn, who, I don't know how he would define himself, he straddles jazz and hip-hop quite a bit. So, but this is an example of stylistic allusion to this earlier style. Thank you. by bebop and many other things as well. And finally, rappers often demonstrate a nostalgia for back in the day, not dissimilar to sentiments found in the work of Jeff Chang, Nelson George, and others. I would argue that this form of hip-hop authenticity is intrinsically concerned with the pursuit of the origin. Foucault, in his essay, Nietzsche, Genealogy and History, quotes Nietzsche from The Wanderer and His Shadow. The lofty origin is no more than, quote, a metaphysical extension which arises from the belief that things are most precious and essential at the moment of birth. This is then Foucault. We tend to think that this is the moment of their greatest perfection, when they emerge dazzling from the hands of a creator or in the shadowless light of a first morning. The origin always precedes the fall. It comes before the body, before the world and time. It is associated with the gods, and its story is always sung as a theogony. In the case of the hip-hop historiography, the early DJs become these gods, and this is a cover of The Source magazine in the States from 1993, and these are generally accepted to be the godfathers of hip-hop, with Kool Herc there, Afrika Bambaataa, Grandmaster Flash there, and I wonder how different this is to other canons like, Bach, Beethoven, things like that. This desire to have the great. Now, I'm not saying their music is the same or anything like that. I'm just talking about their function, within a musical culture. But herein lies the paradox of the hip hop canon. At once, there's a celebration of the founding fathers and an early canon, while praising their approaches, which largely eschewed biomythologies of the artists and music canons. They were playing music, it didn't matter who it was to them. You know, they weren't big on canons, but of course the canon then gets created again. The origins in hip-hop thus become the site of truth and purity in the eyes of historically conscious rap artists and writers, an Eden before the fall being this first death of hip-hop symbolized by commercial success. This historical authenticity reflects an assumption that various popular music genres began in a utopian space, and that any changes to original forms become a corruption of the ideal. And you have this in blues, you have this in jazz, you have this all sorts of places. The many ways that a historical authenticity can be demonstrated in recordings are subject to overlap and often combined in the same single. One example of this is Nas's Hip Hop Is Dead from his 2006 eponymous album. Hip Hop Is Dead uses two classic breakbeats which layer on top of the basic beat at different points in the song. This is the Apache break and Billy Squier's The Big Beat. The breakdown section has Nas rapping a cappella with a chanting crowd, showing his ability to stage hip hop as a live phenomenon. Vinyl scratches also allude to the time when hip-hop began, as the trope states, with two turntables and one mic. The sampling of Iron Butterfly's Inagata Da Vida is worth noting, since this song was used in the early disco scene and was covered on the Incredible Bongo Band's 1973 album, Bongo Rock, along with Apache. Nas looks back to an earlier era in his lyrics, emphasizing a commercial, non-commercial divide which pervades hip-hop nostalgia rhetoric. I'll just play a short clip of this.
Sound the same, commercialize the game, reminiscing when it wasn't all business. They forgot where it started, so we all gathered here for the dearly departed. Hip-hop assist a toddler, one homeboy became a man then a monster. With the ties, and became a last for the roster.
Apache, right?
People donate your lungs to a roster. Went from turntables to MP3s, from B Street to commercials on Mickey D's. From gold cables to Jacobs, from plain facials to Botox and facelifts. I'm looking over my shoulder, it's about 80 minutes from my hood that showed up. And it came to show love, so that concert and the doors are closed shut.
That's the end of the track. Hip Hop Is Dead also reflects the genre's preoccupation with an all-too-real intersection with death and loss. And while many current rappers are technically far more complex than the early MCs and DJs, historical authenticity has little to do with virtuosity, as much as it does with the fetishization of and nostalgia for the origin. As Q-Tip from A Tribe Called Quest said of their second album, The Low End Theory, hip-hop is moving farther and farther away from its true starting point. And what we're trying to do with this album is bring it a little bit closer to home. So to conclude, while all music engages in some form of musical borrowing, the intertwining concepts of history, borrowing, and authenticity in the hip-hop world uniquely affect intercultural borrowing as demonstrating a historical authenticity. As Zamora writes, quote, "I agree with Merleau-Ponty that all cultural texts are intertexts, but writers and readers respond to their textual traditions in different ways and for different purposes, often according to the importance given by a culture to its own history and the history of its interaction with other cultures." Unquote. An overt and heavily saturated intertextuality is part and parcel of the hip-hop aesthetic. And since hip-hop often has an equally overt relationship to history, to its history, borrowing from and making listeners aware of hip-hop history is a key feature within the music. A musical shibboleth such as a classic breakbeat, peer reference, or quotation can educate, demonstrate insider knowledge, and help define cultural boundaries. It is hip-hop's historical self-consciousness embedded in the musical recordings that define historical authenticity. The genre's origins as a performance-based culture rising from the poverty of the Bronx become a source of its so-called essence. While not the only type of authenticity in the genre, historical authenticity will become more significant and widespread as hip-hop undergoes further processes of canonization and legitimization. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please, Jim, you have a question.
I know it wasn't your theme, but if there is a narrative of nostalgia and authenticity and so on, then it follows there must also be a narrative of acculturation, where this, when it moves, it takes on something of the world around it, etc. And I'm just wondering if it's possible to say anything. For example, it would be different when it went to, I assume, to the west coast of America. It would be different when it came over to Europe and found itself in very different kinds of contexts and so on. Is there anything one can say of a generalizing type about that?
Yeah, there's a standard narrative, and it's a very U.S.-centric one, like, many jazz histories are, which I'm not advocating. There's a classic narrative where, in the early 90s, it has to do with what becomes mainstream in the U.S. So in the early 90s, when West Coast hip-hop becomes popular, then that's like a change in the history, in the narrative, in the great works, though they're not called that are associated with that. And then it goes back to the East Coast. And then, around the late 90s or so, the history hasn't really been discussed yet. So I think it's more closely linked with, what becomes mainstream in a certain geographical region. It's kind of, geographical regions is the kind of hinge. Now, what that does with what becomes authentic is you often find, the definitions changing for what true hip-hop is, or even what old school is. So old school for some people is mid-80s Run DMC. So that's a moving target as well. So I'm sort of painting this picture as one type that gets used, but there's many. And I think as time goes on, that sort of memory goes, depending on the age of the people writing it.
I think, there are various bits of Europe where, one could almost see the fashions change. You are taking on fashions from recent pop music. And I guess what is countercultural in the Bronx is not countercultural somewhere in Eastern Europe, for example. I'm just wondering what the different formulations that takes on.
Well, it does get really fascinating when, you start looking at different countries' case studies and what they use and what they don't use. And a lot of times, it's actually the stuff from the early 90s, because at that point, the labels signed with major labels with international distribution. So you'll hear verbal quotations in German hip-hop from early 90s songs, not from early 80s songs, because they didn't have access to that. So I guess going on from this would be the sort of international case studies of it and how that changes. Of course, there's multiple other papers to be had by sort of, you know, national or transnational inflections of different hip-hop scenes, which is interesting as well.
Well, my question is like twofold, and it goes from that concept that you use, pre-recorded hip hop culture, pre-recorded hip hop culture. How did they transmit that culture? And in this case, is it relevant to talk about oral transmission and some kind of oral tradition, whatever? And if it is the case, whether such has been done. Mm.
Can you repeat the first
one? Once again, pre-recorded hip hop culture.
Recorded,
yes?
Yeah.
Yes. In this case, the question is how did they transmit it? Mm. And with that, related to that, is it relevant to speak about some kind of oral transmission and tradition?
Mm. Okay. I'll say to the second that, as far as I see it, it becomes less relevant because of how much of this stuff is recorded. But because of that, the fact that historians consider pre-1979 to not have any recordings gives it this mystique and gives it this, you know, nowadays everyone has a mixtape, everyone's a bedroom producer doing their own thing. So, and that's a sort of different oral tradition, but it's a tradition passed on through recordings and through the internet and things like that. So I guess not oral transmission, but through the internet. So, I mean, like I was saying with the first method, the sort of ancestral method that takes it back to concepts like, you know, oral tradition and things. There's a place when you do those methodologies, or perhaps the sort of internet stuff through mixtapes, people writing about mixtapes and things like that. But the thing is that pre-1979, you know, there are bootleg cassette recordings, there are, which haven't really been released and haven't really been listened to, and maybe it's because, you know, they don't want you to know about it or what it was, right? So it's this kind of mystical time period that's not recorded. Then all of a sudden, 1979 happens and all hip-hop gets recorded as far as the history goes. So that idea of oral tradition isn't there in the history other than that 1979 moment, pre-1979.
Okay, well, can you tell us the records, the hip-hop artists are sadly always in such a bad condition with all those scratches and pops? Or has it some special meaning for example, authenticity?
Yes, absolutely. Joe Schloss's book, Joe Schloss is an ethnomusicologist, and he wrote a book called Making Beats, The Art of Sample-Based Hip-Hop, where he interviews a lot of producers, and he's got a chapter called Sampling Ethics. And I use it a lot in my teaching because, you know, first of all, people don't necessarily follow that, but there's a set of practitioners who feel very strongly that you need to be sampling from a record, right? So that's why you're getting those hisses and pops. Sometimes in the studio, they'll add, as a studio technique, they'll add hisses and pops to make it sound, you know, or a scratching effect rather than actually scratching, because that's a signifier of coolness and hipness, and there is an authenticity there. So that's one of the reasons. Now, not everybody follows that. It's like DJs. DJs, a certain group of DJs think that you've got to have the two turntables, and that's it. Of course, nowadays with technology, you can have a laptop connected to turntables, not even to a record, but, you know, to know where it lies, and you can do it through the laptop as if you're, you know, and so there's all sorts of authenticity debates about that too. But there's not a there's almost a celebration of some of that, you know, noise and disruption and not having things match up completely in hip-hop. There's a sort of celebration of that rather than sort of trying to make everything sound clean and together, and, you know, sometimes they want it to sound disjointed. So the answer to your question is yes. There is something there for many hip-hop producers that want to be, you know, authentic, whereas you listen to the first Britney Spears record and there's a scratching effect. So, you know, it's like with electric guitar riffs and things, there's a kind of coolness effect that then gets seeped into even more mainstream stuff.
That scratching effect came to synthesizers in the 1980s.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe only one short comment or addition. I remember when the first number one hit of a German hip-hop band was launched. Very polished thing, the Fantastischen Vier, and they apologized all the time because they said hip-hop originally wasn't a thing of the lower classes, but in Europe it became a middle-class thing automatically. Mm. So always they apologized. I think they had this myth also internalized already in the early 90s.
What group is that?
The Fantastischen Vier. They were dissolved immediately after. Very polished, very, very clean, nothing what harms you.
Yeah.
And in that nothing what harms you. In that condition, I mean, it's incredible where you can find hip-hop now as a demarcation. I heard a very interesting talk in Japan for about 3 years ago about Chinese hip-hop scene in Rangoon. And as you can imagine, in Burma, there is no social critique in option at all.
Yes.
I mean, quite opposite. But they use it as a kind of marker to distinguish themselves from the continental Chinese, from the motherland.
Yep.
What is a very crazy thing. And I don't think that all these other youth culture habits were imported, because that's something, I would not say subversive, but something which is not allowed in that country.
What's the name of the German group that did Watch Out for the Third Rail, do you know, in the 90s? I'm trying to remember the name of the group in Germany. But my point with that is that Watch Out for the Third Rail is a line from the film Wild Style.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, these other, this knowledge and that, yeah, that's really interesting. Apologies for that.
Yeah.
Thank you.